Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I am an alcoholic. And it certainly is a pleasure and a privilege to be here at Monteagle. And I'm not going to spoil this deal this morning, because this has been beautiful. Fran, Jim, and Willie. And I am one of these in Alcoholics Anonymous that believes that the only way that we can make AA talk is, as our book suggests, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. But before we get started, I want to thank the committee for asking me to be a part of this weekend. Because 7 years ago, I was asked to come and share here at Monteagle. And I had an experience that weekend that I asked to go back, and that is with a bunch of drunks up at Tracy City, and there is a little Episcopal church. And these drunks went in, and I was rather uncomfortable because they went up to the altar and they kneeled, and there was no services going on, and none of them are Catholic, and heck, you don't just don't go in during the day if you're a Protestant, Jew, atheist, dog, or cat. And there they were kneeling, but I did. I saw back behind the altar the most beautiful, leaded and colored, old-fashioned type of glass they put in the church, and that is a scene that's so familiar to many of us, more so maybe to you than to me. And that is the most beautiful man that ever walked the earth. And then he was holding this little lamb and all the little lambs around him. And I didn't realize the impact of it until after I left Monteagle. And I asked George and Jim what they're praying about over there. And they said, we come up here every time and we pray that maybe the drunk that's drinking or the one that's gone back to drinking can see fit to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know in one instance that that prayer worked, because you heard him Friday night. He was one of them. And I asked to go back today, and unashamedly I did that. And I feel a lot better as a result of it. Because one of the most beautiful prayers that I have learned in my life I found in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I came to you people, I didn't know how to pray. And you were saying some things, and I wanted to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything else in the world, because I had no place else to go. I'd been everywhere in this world, up and down and around and in and out. And no one wanted me except people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to my sponsor and I told him I didn't know how to pray. And he said, there are three prayers in the big book, dummy. Read them to him. And so that's how I started reading the big book. And I found that prayer. And it's in the seventh step of the chapter of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in chapter 6, into action. And that it says, and this is unashamedly, and I'm going to start this meeting today this way because I feel this way. And I said, my creator, because willingness to me was one of the hardest things in the world. And I didn't realize that willingness is a degree of honesty, and willingness is a degree of open-mindedness. And when I became willing to let go of me, and when that means when I let go of me, I let go of everything. And as our book says, we turn to our creator then, we say, my creator, I'm willing that you shall have all of me, good and bad, and I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And it doesn't say I pray to keep my wife and keep my kids. It doesn't say that I pray to do this or do that, but I pray that you remove every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so thankful for that experience. The only thing I know about being an alcoholic is how I drank. And the only thing I know about staying sober is and living sober is Alcoholics Anonymous. And since I've been sober this trip, well, I haven't found a reason to find any other way to live sober. And I'm so thankful for that. Because it was the last Sunday in August of 1950 that a group of fine sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an AA birthday party at the old Suburban group there in Dallas. And a lady who was my manicurist at the time, at this barbershop that I frequented once a week, and I was down there, and I looked at her, and Edith looked at me, and she says, David, she says, before we get started today, I want to tell you something. She says, I've been sober 1 year in a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, Edith, you're a liar. Nobody stays sober a year, maybe a day, maybe a week, but not a year. And I had drunk a lot of whiskey with Edith. And she says, no, I haven't had a drink in a year. And this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous and this AA group that I belong to, they have a birthday party at the last Sunday of every month for those who have 1 or more years of consecutive sobriety. And we want you and your wife to come to that AA birthday party. And I looked at Edith in utter amazement. Now, that day, I happened to be at myself. Now, being at myself in those days was I wasn't falling out of the barber chair every 10 minutes. But I noticed that Edith had changed, that something had happened to Edith. Number one, she wasn't grabbing her purse and running into the ladies' room. She quit smelling that day like a, you know, halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. And this was back in the days before the ladies used to wear pantyhose and used to wear garter belts. And always I'd be down there and her garter belt trail behind her uniform. She'd trip and fall and drop those bottles. And in those days, the ladies used to wear hose with seams up the back with them garter belts. You could always tell when Edith was drunk, the seams in the front and back. Now, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like, you know. Well, she's a sort of female Hawkins, you know. And she wasn't very pretty. Her face looked like a truck had run over and then backed over. In our part of the country, I don't know about here, if your car is out in a hailstorm and the insurance adjuster gives you a check and some wise person says, keep your check, wait till it's, keep it out in the hot sun for 3 or 4 days and them dents will pop back out. Well, her dents never popped back out. And her nose, God bless it, had been broken so many times on the left side of her face. And she had big bug eyes, but God, she was beautiful. But I noticed the change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sick eyes. And we have those sober, dancing, happy, laughing, grateful eyes. And then we got another kind of eyes, you know, them glassy eyes. I haven't had a drink, you know, in a year and then fall off the podium. But her eyes had changed, and God, she was beautiful, and her eyes were dancing and laughing. And she turned to another lady, also a manicurist, in the same barbershop by the name of Moena. And she says, now, Moena here has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's my sponsor. And I looked at Moena, and I had drunk a lot of whiskey with Moena. And I said, Moena, no, you haven't been sober that long. She says, yes, I have. I haven't had a drink in 15 months. Edith hadn't had a drink in a year. I am her sponsor. And she's going to sell her birthday the last Sunday, which will be the next Sunday, and we want you and your wife be sure to come to that birthday party. And I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you kind of people in the community. And God, y'all needed help, and I was glad to come help you. So I went home and told my wife, and God, she was excited because people had long since quit asking us to come around, you know. And she used to ask me, David, not David, she called me other names, you know. And she said, why is it we're not asked to come to the outdoor barbecues? Why aren't we asked to come to the bridge parties, the domino parties, the ice cream stuff? I said, it's you. I said, every time we get ready to go to one of those things, before we go, you say, you're not going to drink. You're not going to get drunk, are you? And you yakety-yak all the way there. And then when you get there, You chase the host and the hostess out of the kitchen, in the den, in the backyard, in the kitchen, around the block, in the bushes, and you scream at him, "Don't you give him another drink. Don't you give him another drink." Woman, you're sick. That's what's wrong with you. And so she said through tear-filled eyes, "But are we going to that meeting?" And I said, "Yes." And so that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 to get ready to go to an AA birthday party 5:30 that afternoon. Now, what does a good, self-respectful drinking drunk do when he gets up Sunday morning at 5:30? He drinks whiskey. That's what he does. It's simple. Let's face it. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, and drunks drink. And that's all there's to it. And I started sucking on a fifth of whiskey, and I got it half down, and I knew that I was going to have me a drink later on, not knowing the reason for it for many years. And I put it in the trunk of the car for my reserve. And I put on everything fine that I had that day. I put on a beautiful tailor-made suit, and I put on a white-on-white monogram shirt, monogram drawers, monogram handkerchief, put on my diamond ring, my diamond Rolex watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling, drinking drunk, a brand-new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. And at 10:30 in the morning, I was out in the car honking the horn. And out comes Grace with the rollers, and she's got on, you know, that Al-Anon, "It's all your fault" kimono, you know. No buttons on it, cigarette burns in it, you know, and wrapped around like this. "If I hadn't have married you, it wouldn't be this way." And she says, "What do you want, drunk?" And that hurts a feller's feeling on Sunday morning. I said, "Let's go to the meeting." She says, "It doesn't get started for 7 more hours." And God, and she went back in the house. And that started 7 of the most hellacious hours, because it was Sunday. And the only whiskey I had was in the trunk of that car. And I knew I was going to have me a drink later on. And I was going to be out with her and you folks. And I figured the best thing to do was to tough it out, get it over with, and then go get drunk. And so consequently, I didn't want to touch the reserve, so I started looking in the garage, in the bushes, and in coats, and behind the alleys and trash cans for a half pint of whiskey. I'd find cigarette butts and all, and just drink it down, because I knew what I wanted to drink. It was the alcohol. And finally, at 4:30, I was out in the car again, honking the horn, and I said, "Let's go, woman," and off we went to the meet. And we got out there. And as we was going, getting ready to go up the steps, there's two drunks sitting on the steps. And one of them said something to me, and I said something back. And he said something to me, and he got up, and I hit him, and I parked him over here. And his buddy that was sitting over there, and they wouldn't let him come into the meeting because they were drunk. And I thought that was terrible. After all, I'm coming to what they say Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but it had anything to do with alcohol. I was it, and I knew that. And his buddy sitting over here took offense at what I'd done to his friend, and he stood up, and he made a pass at me, and I hit him, and I parked him over there, and I said, "Now, you two little boys, be good. I'm going in here. It's going to take me about 20 minutes to straighten out this bunch of goonies, and then I'm going to come back out here, and I know where some whiskey is, and all three of us are going to have a drink." Now, you know, that's the first principle we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're going to tell a drunk you're going to do something, do it. If you tell him you're going to come visit with him, do it. If you tell him you ain't going to visit with him, don't visit with him. If you're going to tell him you're going to give him a drink, and if you're going to, you tell a drunk that's drinking you're going to give him a drink, he'll sit there just like one of them little trained poodles, just waiting for you and panting. And so that's that quiet in that bunch. And I went on in. I went in this place, and there must have been about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, their wives and their kids and their dogs and their poodles and God and in there, and everybody talking, and nobody listening, hugging and kissing and smoking cigarettes, you know. You know how it is when you get around a bunch of about 80 sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, at a meeting or a place like this, you don't. You're talking to one of them, they just walk away from you, you know. You're sitting down talking to somebody, somebody comes in, sits down, butts in, sits in your lap, sits in their lap. "How you doing?" "Everybody's fine." They get up and they leave, and they say, "Who is that?" "I don't know. I haven't been to a meeting in 2 weeks. Place changed." And I looked around, and I saw all them signs, first things first. I said, "My God, I'm in a kindergarten, you know." And then I saw, but for the grace of God, my head ducked, because I knew then that the way I was living and the drinking and the things that were happening to me were not in the code of God's way of life. I knew that, and there isn't an alcoholic that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't know that. And the only reason that an alcoholic don't want to believe in God, he just don't want to. We're the greatest don't want a people that ever is. Because I don't know about anybody here, it meant that I would have to tell you the truth. That I had been lying all these years about my Creator, the Master Father, and all the things, and we'll get into that a little bit later on. I don't know about anybody else. I'm going to talk about only about my own experience. And then I looked around, I saw the most dangerous sign I believe you can put in an AA facility, and I still believe it, and that's the one that says, think. Because it's dangerous for our kind of folks to think it. If you don't believe it, you pat a little drunk on the head, and you tell him how good he's doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and let him get over in the corner, and start thinking for himself, and he'll get drunker than an $8 bill on you. And they blew a whistle, and I went on in the meeting, and I got on the back row. Because I wanted to look you people over well, see what kind of help I could afford to give you. And the first celebrant was a woman, and she got up and went, my God, not the one that invited us to come to that birthday party. And when she stood up and said that she was sane and sober in her right mind and hadn't had a drink in a year, I stood on the back chair and I hollered out, liar. Because that's the most dishonest person I'd ever known in my life. And somebody said, shut up and sit down. And this woman started talking about a miracle, 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 miracle. Never said nothing but just kept saying this miracle, miracle. What seemed to me like 10 minutes. And finally I couldn't stand it any longer and I stood back up on the chair and I said, well, tell it, liar, you know. And somebody said, sit down and shut up. And she says, result of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, she caught Christ back in her life. And if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, lest she found Jesus and the Christ as the power greater than themselves in this program, that there was no way that they could stay sober at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself at that time, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew. That y'all invited me to that deal to convert me. That's what you did. And if this is what you were, I needed to drink bad. Now, I'm asked all the time, how come there are not any more Jews in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it's very simple. Because the way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to in an age. But my mind closed, and I didn't hear anything that was said at that meeting. Nothing that was said at that meeting. Because I violated a very serious code of my living at that meeting at that time. Because I started drinking with, working with, getting drunk with, fighting with, cheating with, everything. With a black and a white wino, which was then Skid Row. It's Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I've lived on 3 Skid Rows in my lifetime, one for over 6 years, one for over 4.5 years. And the last 14 months was the toughest, and I'm going to stand up here this morning and share that life with you. No, it's not the Skid Row in your bathroom, and it's not the Skid Row in your living room, and it's not the Skid Row anyplace else but Skid Row. And the best way that I can describe it as a land of never, never land, of total anesthesia, inner and outer total blackness and darkness. And the best way I can describe it is just bodies and feet. Because, you see, I went to work for the father of a friend of mine when I was a youngster, 11 and a half years of age, and I didn't have to be down there. Because I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. I had a mother and father that gosh, was the greatest mother and father that any son could ever want. A mother and father that were both born in Europe, 28 miles from each other. And they didn't meet until they met in Dallas, Texas. They fell in love and they were married. And they both immigrated from the old country because of religious oppression. Because they had heard that in the United States of America that they could worship the God of their understanding and they could be free and good people. And 2 sons were born to that marriage, and I being the oldest. And my mother and father dedicated their lives to give to the 2 boys that were born to that marriage everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to be an alcoholic, I don't know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that'll give you everything in this world and bail you out of everything in order to keep the family name going, you know, and not to bring any shame. My mother and father could not read or write English. They went to night school to learn how to read and write. And my father went to work and he became a tremendous financial success. He had a very simple formula. He bought something for $2 and sold it for $6. He never wrote an insufficient check. He put money in the bank. He started education funds for his children and his grandchildren. He was a man that, as he grew up the ladder, both financially and civically, and as he grew spiritually, but spiritually first. And I couldn't see this because he believed and he loved God. So did Mother. Everything good was happening to that man, and he was well-respected and well-liked. And if I'd listened to my mother and father time I was 40 years of age, I never would have had to work another day in my life. I would have had enough money for all my great-great-grandchildren, all y'all's great-great-grandchildren, and a lot's left over. And so I never fell out with them because they could not provide the love and they could not provide the understanding that a youngster needed growing up like Willie. You know, everything was just there. It was just there. Now, the only time I ever fell out with them is when I got into trouble and I got into jails and I got into a lot of institutions and other things. And I'd go to them, I'd look at my father, and my father look at my mother. Now, my mother ran the family. And when she was 75 years of age, she's only 4'11½". And she had a backhanded slap with a right hand that's faster than any rattlesnake you've ever seen. My daddy's afraid of her. Her rabbi's afraid of her. Everybody's afraid of my mother. And my mother would have gone to her grave absolutely believing she never did anything wrong in her life. She never told a lie in her life that she was perfect. And she used to tell me, she said, David, if you would just do what I tell you to do and have done what I told you, you never would have gotten into all the trouble that you were getting into or gotten into. And I had to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous to find that all of the principles that my mother and father tried to instill in me from the moment that I was born as a youngster growing up until I left home were the same principles I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now you say, well, why don't you return back to where those principles of the church and of the religion? Now I'm going to tell you a little story. 9½ years before I got sober, my mother and father, they had all the means they could stand. And in the religion they were born in, lived in, and died in, and loved dearly, they lit the candles of the dead and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days, and on the 8th day their son was no longer alive in their mind. He was dead as far as they were concerned. He was no longer on this earth. And that's the greatest thing in the world they could have done for them. That's total release to a degree. I had no communication with my family after I got sober, and it concerned me. Everybody wants to be needed, and everybody wants to be wanted. That's part of the nature of the illness. The older members of Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor says, David, if you do what the program says to do, you cannot help but become a better person as a result of it, nor can you help come to the attention of others. And when I was 4½ years sober, as I said, and I had no communication, that's going on 14 years, my brother came to me and he says, Mother wants to see you. And I says, Your mother. He says, No, our mother. I says, I have no mother and I have no father. My brother's the only one that would ever come around and check on me after I got sober. No, not the last years I drank, nobody. And he says, Mother wants to see you. He said, Well, will you go for me? And I says, I'll go for you. And he says, All right. He says, You come out to my house, and you go in the garage, and you go in the door that the dog goes through. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me. It was a storm door, and I had a pass through at the bottom so the dog could go in and out. And so they didn't have to get up from the television table and from the company, and the dog come in. And you go through that door, and you go in my son's room, and then you go out of his room, in the hall, into the dining room, and the door will be closed in the dining room. You sit there. And so I went. And I sat in the dining room alone, and my little mother came in, and she was beaming from ear to ear. And she wasn't crying. And she had that good look in her eye. And she walked over and she kissed me on my forehead and called me her son for the first time in almost 14 years. And she says, you know, I've been wrong about you. And for my mother to say that, that was something. She says, I've been wrong about you. And unbeknownst to me, she'd become an Al-Anon. And they'd taken her in Al-Anon's newcomers packet home with all that literature and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And unbeknownst to me, she had been reading for over a year or so or two everything about alcoholism and everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says, I've been wrong about you. She says, because many a night I'd wake up Pop in the bed and I said, Papa, are you sure that when that boy was born, they delivered us the right baby? That he doesn't fit the mold. And she said, but I've been wrong about you. And she says, I found out that no matter what we did to you, with you, and for you, or any other human could do to and with and for you, including yourself, that you have an illness, that only a power greater than yourself can arrest one day at a time if you're willing to live that way. And she says, I am so thankful that you're sober, and I am so thankful that you have now living and found the God of your understanding. And she says, now, she says, just because I've kissed you on the forehead and called you son, don't you think you can come running back in here and wait for all this money you think you're going to get? And don't you come back and think that now you can associate with us and butter us up and do these things that we're doing. She says, because I want to remind you something, son. And she looked at me, and she wasn't sitting, she was standing. And she says, you see, when you leave Alcoholics Anonymous to get out here and become something else other than a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and do what you're supposed to do, she says, because you see, when you do that, you turn your back on the people who loved you when nobody else loved you. They wanted you when nobody else wanted you. We didn't want you. You were dead. You had no friends. Nobody wanted you around. But those people saw fit to love you and want you and need you. And when you turn your back on those people, then you're turning your back on God. And she says, son, when you turn your back on God, I am afraid you will drink again. She says, I know that I have only one wish. She says, not for your father. And she says, it's not for your brother and his family or your wife and your children. She says, I know you're not supposed to stay sober for anybody else. But she says, if I have one eternal wish, is that you remain a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, I would much rather have a sober son as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous than have a son that just is not drinking and a big shot in this outside world. And then she kissed me on my forehead and she says, now, again, she says, now you're 30 minutes late to your meeting. And she says, you tell them folks in AAA, she used to call it AAA, how much I love them. And she looked in the den at where I knew my father was. And she says, and don't worry about that old goat. He's got a stopped-up mind. Now, to her, that was a closed mind. She picked up all the little sayings in her little way, you know, and I go on. Now, that's almost worth getting sober for, but it will not keep you sober. You see? And I started learning a lot of things down on Skid Row as a youngster, 11 and a half. I started drinking bay rum and wine. That's a standard fare. That's what we were drinking back in those days. And as I grew older physically and get more money in my pocket, you know, and I'd go from that bay rum and wine to that good Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch, never miss a lick. And I'd come back down from that good Black Label Jack Daniels down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird, never miss licks. Because I don't know about anybody in here, I wasn't drinking it because of the price of it, the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it was socially acceptable. I wasn't drinking it because of this, that. I was drinking it because I liked the effect that it produced within me. And alcohol, like Willie, it's been around my family all my waking hours. You're supposed to drink. It's good for the appetite. Everybody drink it. They used to keep a bottle for the rabbi in a special glass. Nobody could drink out of it. I did. Didn't make me a rabbi. But we were told, drink like a gentleman. Don't drink like a bum. Don't become a glutton. Don't become a drunkard. That's what's bad, you know. And little did I realize that the first drink of alcohol that I could consciously remember when I was 6 years of age, affected me in such a way that I liked the effect that it produced within me. And little did I realize that right there and then it planted something in my head that every chance I'm going to get, I'm going to take me a drink of alcohol that'll reproduce that initial effect. And right there and then, it was the beginning of a problem, and I didn't know this. And so consequently, I learned a lot of things down on Skid Row. Never let a stranger put his arm around your back. I'd stick a knife in it. Always have a back door window you can jump out of. You drank wine like I did, you'll understand that. You know, it just straightens you up and lays you out and just immobilizes you. And you've got that goofy look, and you've got that up toes, up heel, sideways walk like a car that's out of line. When you're going this way, and everything, batting your eyes and grinning, you know, and everything's just fine. And for a youngster, you know, 11 and a half and 12, 13 and 14, it's great. And all these things. And here I am. I'm sitting in that back row. There's no back window to jump out. There is no door to jump out of. And that woman talked about Christ and my mind closed. And I wanted to drink bad. And it wasn't until after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they shoved the big book in my hand. And may I remind every alcoholic in this room and every Al-Anon, every friend of AA, that it is the only book in print with the two words on it. There is not another book in this world like it. There's not one better than, less than, greater than, worse than. If it ain't it, it ain't it, you know. And I have to ask, I look around here and I don't see anybody that's here. There was one of the 100 that wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. No. And so I am led to believe that when we say we're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it be in our groups or to anyone else, I have to simply admit that I am the results of what was in that book. And I have to ask myself daily, what kind of result am I? Is it the one of a figment of my own imagination? Is it the result of having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? Is this the message, other than the 12-step call and helping a drunk shake out a drunk, is this the message that I am trying to carry to the alcoholic? Am I living the principles of the program that when I tell an alcoholic, then he says after he gets physically a little bit detoxified, if this is what you want to use, or he gets sober, or he feels like coming up and says, can I go with you? Am I living the kind of life that when I say, yes, you can pick up your bed and walk too, am I living the kind of life that he's willing to walk? Am I an example of what this program can do? Or I'm just doing this just to show off. Am I doing this because I love it and I really want to? I have to ask myself. This is part of my daily inventory. Now maybe you'll understand the reason that I knelt yesterday at the altar and I asked God to remove these defects that sometimes when I work with an alcoholic or I explain alcoholics, I get carried away with my own self. Because AA has been so good to me. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous have been so good to me. And I was told early in Alcoholics Anonymous, and as Willie said last night, you give it away only in the manner in which you're capable of giving it away. And if we still cling and hold on to those things, they're not willing to let go. We have a way to do that by just simply ask him to make us willing to do these things. But there's many years before I was to find this out. And so I'm sitting there and I'm hating it. And as I said, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous many years later and they shoved the book in my hand and I found out exactly what was wrong with me at that time at that meeting in the doctor's opinion. And there's a piece of writing that's never been changed from the time Dr. John Silkworth wrote it in hand and then they reproduced it and reprinted in the big book. It's every comma, every word as he'd written it. And he writes that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. God, when I saw that and I read that and I began to understand it, that shot the balloon out of the air. I thought I was drinking because kind of woman I was married to. I thought I was drinking because the Republicans were in, the Democrats were out. I thought I was drinking because the chinch bugs got the crop. I thought I was drinking because I'd been recalled back in services. No, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And although we will admit it is as elusive and it is injurious, there isn't an alcoholic in this room that hadn't admitted that it's elusive. Somebody, he comes staggering in and says, "Where have you been?" "Oh, I went in to watch the Falcons play in the saloon." And they say, "Well, that's Sunday, and here it is Friday." "Well, I just went in there to watch them." They're in an alcoholic. They admit it's not injurious. You know, "Oh, yeah, I know I'm drinking too much." You tell an alcoholic you keep drinking, your liver's going to get hard. As long as he can run in and press flesh, they're lying. You tell an alcoholic you keep drinking, you're going to get a wet brain. As long as he can stand in the mirror and scratch his head, dandruff fly out, they're lying. The argument that can hold and interest these alcoholics must have depth and weight, and frothy emotional appeal will not suffice. This is also the doctor's writing. If you haven't read it, I suggest you do it. And then the doctor says, and then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. Well, doesn't everybody get drunk Christmas? Doesn't everybody get drunk New Year's Eve? Doesn't everybody get drunk on St. Patrick's Day? Doesn't everybody get drunk on Friday and Saturday and spend part of his paycheck and fight with his family? Doesn't everybody do that? And then we cannot differentiate the true from the false, and then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. We're restless, irritable, and discontented. I never was restless and irritable and discontented. When I was drinking, I was drunk. It's in between drunks that I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And until we can again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once after taking a few drinks. Drinks that we see others taking with impunity. My wife used to say, "Why don't you drink like Herman?" I said, "I don't want to drink like Herman. Don't even like him." She said, "Why don't you drink like Stanley?" I said, "Well, get Stanley and his wife over to the house." And she'd get Stanley and his wife over to the house on Saturday. I'd be the bartender, and I'd fix Stanley drinks like I was drinking, you know. And I'd say, "Oh, come on, Stanley. Oh, you that's not a drink. That's a thimble. Drink it. Drink it." And an hour and a half later, Stanley would be drunk, passed out on the living room floor on his back. My foot would be on his navel, and I'd look at my wife, and I'd say, "And you want me to drink like this bum?" My wife used to say, "Why don't you drink like a man?" I said, "I'm drinking with both fists. What else you want me to do?" Here's a good one. People used to say, "David, don't you drink anymore." I didn't need any more. What I was drinking was doing the job. But once we succumb to the desire again, and unfortunately many of us will, here comes the thing that separates us from the so-called normal drinker, social drinker, or whatever. I don't know about you, but a normal drink for me is take a half pint of whiskey, take the cap off, suck it down in one swallow, and throw the empty away. Now, that's a drink. I've been sober now for a while, and I've been in a lot of cocktail lounges, and I've been in, you know, for reasons there not to drink, but for the reason to be there, and I've been on planes, and I've never seen a fine little old lady come in and say to the cocktail waitress, "Bring me a half pint of whiskey, no water, no glass, with the cap on it." And she brings it, and she takes the cap off, sucks down one swallow, and said, "Bring me another." I haven't seen that yet, you know. What's normal? What's normal? What's normal for me was normal for me, what's normal for you was normal for you. That's not it. We have something else that caused us to do the things after we drank. And that's the common malady, as we call it in Alcoholics Anonymous. A mental obsession of the mind to drink alcohol, living a lifestyle on our own, and a physical compulsion, living a lifestyle on our own that condemns us to die if we continue to drink. And then when we drank, we got drunk. That's the same thing for all of us. What happened to me after I drank happened to me. What happened to you happened to you. But it happened because we couldn't stay sober. That's the reason it happened. We could not keep from taking that first drink. And so consequently, as I said before, and then we go through, once we drop that juice in us, here sets up this thing that the little doctor wrote in our book. It set up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. Remember I told you that when I was getting dressed that Sunday morning at 5:30, I started drinking whiskey. And it wasn't what that woman said about Christ or anything else in that meeting. My body was screaming out for another drink. It was craving another drink, this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. My God, how my body craved alcohol. And I couldn't have a drink. And then the doctor says, and then we go through this well-known spree, ending up remarkable and screaming to anybody listening to us, "We'll never do it again." Yet we did it again and again and again and again. And here's where the little doctor lays out
the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous so beautifully and so simply when he says, until such a person undergoes an entire psychic change. Now, how do we undergo this entire psychic change in Alcoholics Anonymous? As a result of our ideals that are firmly grounded in a power greater than ourselves. And how do we ground our ideals firmly in a power greater than ourselves? Steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And then a lot of the alcoholics stop. And their spiritual growing stops. They will not live within the spiritual framework that keeps the thing going for us, our groups, all of our service boards and entities whose primary purpose is to see that the message of alcoholic is carried to the alcoholic in the manner in which it is. We have no other business. That's the only business we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to carry the message. We have no other business, and we got to be sober in order to do that. And so they will not live traditions 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. The only time many of us live the tradition is this, well, now that it's violated, let's go see old Tom or somebody and how to get the ox out of the ditch. And then we won't understand the reason for our third legacy. And then to cap it all, as Bill so beautifully said, to put the roof on the cathedral, the 12 concepts of world service. So that the alcoholic that's born right here in Mount Eagle this morning, not knowing that he's going to be an alcoholic, to the alcoholic that was sitting out here on his drag yesterday, the wino, that hopped off the train, that know that there's a better way to live. And it's our job to find him. And it's our job to hug him and to love him. Because this was done to every one of us when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Then the doctor says, now, until such a person undergoes this entire psychic change, I said before, there's very little hope for his recovery. But once such a person undergoes this entire psychic change, a person that was doomed hopeless and helpless and useless, now can very easily, and had so many problems he could never comprehend how he would ever be able to solve them, now can very easily control his desire to drink. The only thing being that he'd be willing to follow a few simple rules. Many years before I was to learn that. And after that meeting was over with, I ran through those people and went, got out to my car. Everybody else went to the coffee and the cake and ice cream. And I opened up the trunk and I got that half quart of liquid gold out. Now, I don't know about anybody in here, but I drank that half fifth down in two swallows. Now, that's the way I drank liquor. I didn't put it in the brandy glass and run around and sniff it for 4 or 5 hours and burn candles and incense and listen to Lawrence Welk. And as Willie said, I didn't put an inch in it, 8 inches, something else, straw and fruit and cherry, and suck on it for about 2 or 3 hours. To me, that's sick drinking. I drank her to drop her down that hole where it'll do the most good and then put another one down there. I've had a lot of them taste just good, come back up, did going down. Don't mind telling you. But let me tell you what happened to me. I quit being restless, irritable, and discontented. My hair laid down. I quit perspiring. The toes went into my alligator shoes. And I ran past those two drunks on the steps right into that AA meeting, got hold of the oldest sober member that got sober in that group. He's still alive, still the oldest continuous sober member in that group. And we got to arguing about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I said something to him. He said something back, I said something, he said something, and I hit him. I was awful bad to hit folks. And two of his AA babies joined in, and we had a fight, and four of them picked me up, two on each side bodily, and threw me right out of that group, right over those drunks on the steps, right out in the yard, and it hurt my feelings. And as I was sailing through the air, one of them said, we don't need your kind here, and another one said, and anyway, you're too young to be an alcoholic. And I stood on that yard that Sunday evening, drunk and belligerent and mad and screaming to anybody to listen to me, that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I live.
that I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic, yet I was 30 years of age at the time. And I wasn't going to tell anybody that I had already been apprehended numerous times. Not for just being drunk, running around with a lampshade on my head. That you can apologize for if they don't hit you first. But for being in blackouts and being in jails and laying out on the road, riding freight cars, everything. In the next 17 years after I left that meeting, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only two things that never did happen to me is I never did willfully murder another human being or die drunk. Other than that, everything in this God's world happened to me. And we hear it all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if you get drunk and again, everything you missed on your last drunk will surely happen to you. Well, if I get drunk again, don't I have a brilliant future? And I was recalled back in the service, and I didn't have to go back into the service. But it gave me a chance to get way away from my creditors and get away from the wonderful woman that I married, two wonderful little boys that were born. And she was demanding, she was nagging, she was demanding things. You know, she had to have money for unnecessary things like baby shoes and baby clothes. And that gets in the way of a drunk when he's drinking. You got to stop and write another one of them things that runs around the world on rubber. And you got to start doing this and doing that. And that interferes with your business. And it messes up everything. The routine begins to get messed up. The family becomes liars. The family becomes full of fear. The family, my God, what have I married, you know? What have I gotten into? As that beautiful Al-Anon talked yesterday about it. She got into a world that she wasn't prepared for. She wasn't raised for this kind of living. And you know, us drunks, and you know, we marry the most wonderful women in the world. The most wonderful women in the world. Because, you see, I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk. I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk. My marriage relationship didn't break down totally after I got sober. It started breaking down long ago, brick by brick by brick by brick. Utter, utter, utter mystery, utter, utter befuddlement, inner and outer blackness and fear and all of these things. Because I said I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk, I'd be gone 6 weeks at a time, 7, 8, 9 weeks at a time. One time I was gone 7 months. No one knew where I was. My wife didn't know where I was. My mother and father were going crazy. I had no communication. They didn't know where I was. And I come home with the same clothes I'd had on for about 6, 7 weeks. And I come running in the house. And I asked my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And Grace took one look at me. And of course, you know, I'm home. And I run up. I want to hug her and kiss her. She said, get away from me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. And our kind of belligerent, we can't take no for an answer, and incidentally, we can't handle a yes most of the time either. And I'd run, and I'd make another pass at her, and she said, I said, get away from me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. Get out of my life. And I'd look at her stunned. And I'd grab that long-neck whiskey bottle, I'd go in the living room, and I'd get my favorite drinking glass, which was an 8-ounce peanut butter jar. Now, that's a respectable drink. And I'd already be drunk, and I'd slosh in that stuff, and I'd pour it down me, and I'd sit in that chair, and I'd close my left eye and put my left hand over my left eye, and my right eye would be open, and I'd sit there, and I'd glare and mumble. And I'd wait to catch her profile when she come from the kitchen into the dining room, the bedroom, to check on the two little boys. And I'd look at her and I says, my God, what's going to happen to me next? Here she is. She's only 26 and a half years old, and she's already going through the early change of life, you know. Of all the things that had to happen to me, it's just my luck to have married a 26 and a half year old frigid woman. And if this be the case, I'm going out and I'm going to find me the woman that will understand me. And so I grabbed my whiskey bottle and I went out in the world looking for the woman that would understand me. And I looked all over the world for the woman that would understand me. And after I was sober, 3 1/2 weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked in the kitchen. There she was. She'd been there all along. Raising the creditors and lying to the creditors and my God and all these things. But you see, the thing that was totally destroying her, Here she saw the man that she married and loved with every fiber of her being was totally disintegrating himself in front of her eyes, and she and the people who loved me the most were helpless and powerless to do anything about it. I looked all over the world for people that would understand me. I couldn't find you. No wonder you all in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come in and said, "We understand you," with that grin, and that just shot that balloon out of the air. You see, I could have long told you what happened to me when I drank. I couldn't guarantee my behavior. By an experience that I had, I was living in a little town in West Texas, and I decided that things were getting a little bit better, and I decided I'm going to go to Dallas 280 miles to drink. And so I got me two sacks full of whiskey, and I put on the clothes, and I had a pocket full of money as a result of another couple of hot checks. And I got in my car, and off I'm going. And I'm drinking, and I'm singing, and just riding along on the road and drinking and singing how great I am. And all this and all that. Look in the mirror, straighten your tie, do this. God, I'm going to really tie one on this time. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting with a strap around my waist, and I have a shirt and a pair of pants and shoes on, and I feel around, and there's nothing in my pockets. And I look around, and half the people have fur hats and coats on, and the other have warm clothing. Half of them are talking in French, and the other half are talking in English. And I don't know where I am. And I surmise that I'm on an airplane. And if there's anything an alcoholic hates to do or scared to do when he's drinking, and he don't know where he is, to ask somebody where he is. And I'm hoping that somebody will just say, "Hello. How are you? Where are you from?" And I could say the same. And finally, this voice on the intercom says, "We are landing in Calgary, Alberta," which is Canada, "and you'll have to go through customs." And the last thing I remember, I was between Amarillo, Texas, and Wichita Falls. And how I ever got on that airplane, I don't know. Still don't know. And so I said to myself, "Well, I'll hide under the seat. Maybe when they stop, the plane turns around, I'll go back with it." But they're not fair. They make everybody get off. And so here I'm going through customs, and you go down in a hole, and I said, "Well, I'll be at the last. Maybe they'll forget me." Finally, everybody goes through customs, and the man waves me in immigration. He says, "Come here." And I go. He says, "Where are your papers?" I says, "Mister, I don't even have a ticket." He says, "You don't?" I says, "No." He said, "How'd you get on the airplane?" I says, "I was going to ask you that." He says, "You don't have papers, you don't have it." I says, "Nothing, search me." He says, "Well, where are you from?" I said, "The United States." He says, "Where were you born in the United States?" I said, "Dallas, Texas." He says, "You have no papers identifying?" He says, "Well, what's your full name?" I said, "David Henry Aronofsky." He said, "Can you prove it?" I said, "Mister, you don't make up a name like that. You either have it or you don't, you know." "Oh, I know what's coming next. The Royal Mounted Police, the call to Daddy, the bailing out of the money, all of those things, you know." That was my pattern. I got called back into service, and I had an awful time. You know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, Willie touched on it about having a bad day, you know. My God, this is a bad day. You know, we got little drunks, you know, they come into the meeting, and they said, "You never will happen what happened to me. Their hair's out this way, and their eyes are flying, and God, they're all up just like this, just like they got electric shock going through them." He said, "I was driving down the freeway at 7:30 this morning going to work, and my fan belt broke." Now, any normal idiot, you know, when the fan belt breaks, you know, he gets out, raises the hood, gets a ride, goes to the filling station, comes back in 45 minutes, he's on his way. But not a little drunk. He says, "I stayed in the car, and I said the Lord's Prayer. I got my 24-hour book out. I said the Serenity Prayer. I couldn't get my sponsor because his CB wasn't working. And I'm there. And guess what? I didn't take a drink." You know, we hear about a bad day. I'm going to tell you about a bad day. And this was Christmas of 1954. And for things that happened to me after I got, because I was recalled back to service as a naval dental officer with a combat marine division. And for things that happened to me as a result of my drinking, I found myself totally incarcerated in a military prison with a chain locked around, I mean, with a leg iron locked around my right leg and a chain welded to the leg iron, the other end of the chain welded to a steel cot, and a full leg of steel cot immersed in concrete. And there are Marines around me 24 hours a day with M1 rifles, fixed bayonets, daring me to move. And I was facing 25 years in the federal penitentiary, the loss of my franchise as a citizen, and naturally the loss of everything else for things that happened to me. And I'd been like that for 7.5 months. And because of my insolence and because of my belligerence and because of my uncooperativeness, 4.5 months of those 7.5 months, I was on continuous bread and water with just enough of a meal to satisfy the military coat. And here it is, Christmas of 54, and I'm hating society. Because I know hundreds of people that have done far worse than I have done, and they're out running free, why me, boo-hoo. And at 12 o'clock noon, in comes this Marine orderly with the Christmas meal. Now, I've been in a lot of places to where they don't give you knives and forks, just spoons. And they don't let you go back to your little iron doggy house until they count the spoons. And he comes in, and he's beaming, and he says, ho, 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 Merry Christmas. And I was so full of resentment, I hollered back, ho, 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 you know what. He said, here's your Christmas dinner. And I was so grateful for the Christmas dinner. When he handed me the tray, I turned around and I hit him right in the face with it. And my Christmas gift for doing that on Christmas Day of 1954 was 45 more days on bread and water. Now, that's a bad day. I have not seen a day that bad since I have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Oh, I got out of that due to my mother and father and everything. Yes, I didn't get any prison time, but I had a lot of bad things happen to me. My wife talked me back, and we started moving around, moved out in West Texas. And I was drinking every day. And I got up to where I weighed 260 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time my pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight up and pump like an oil well. And I had a fat doctor friend lived up in a little town towards Amarillo, went to see old George. And old George took one look at me, and he said, my God, David, you're sick. And I said, I am. And so he put the cuff on and ran the air up, and he says, my God, it's a miracle you're alive, your blood pressure's high. He said, David, your problem is, he says, you eat too much, you're a compulsive eater. Didn't say anything about not drinking any alcohol. He says, you're a compulsive eater. And he says, I'm going to have to give you some help. And so he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules you've ever seen in your life, them, you dons. He says, now take them as directed. And so I went back home and had it filled and went home to lose weight and stay drunk. Well, I looked at the prescription and said, take one 3 times a day. Well, any self-respectful drinking drunk knows if one's good, two's better, three's terrific. So I took 3 of them and drank some whiskey. Wasn't losing no weight. Took 3 more and drank some more whiskey. Ran in the bathroom, looked sideways, wasn't losing any weight. Come out and got a handful of them. Drank some more whiskey. Finally, I took them all, drank all the whiskey I could find. The next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard, and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. And they tell me I ran around that little town of 3,500 for 2 days talking in an unknown tongue. And being one of 2 Jewish families in 5 counties around, they gathered everybody in to see the miracle. Because word had spread like wildfire. The Jew had caught the Holy Ghost. And when I come to and realize what happened, I said, my God, them pills are messing up my drinking. Oh, I'd been to the psychiatrist and all the questions he asked me, my wife used to ask me for nothing, you know. Oh, we moved back, had to. My wife went to work in an area that she hated with every fiber of her being, where I started drinking as a youngster, 11 and a half years of age. And I started once again, but I couldn't operate after a week. And I started living in those 45-cent a night hotel rooms. And I'd close that old office up. I couldn't function anymore because everything was gone. I tried to kill myself two times last year. I drank and ended up in jail both times. And I condemned my own self, my own mind, that I was helpless and hopeless and useless. That everything near and dear was gone. I had no family. I had no mother and father. I had no wife and children. And I got down to all I had was just a pair of thermal underwear, an old pair of gray flannel pants with all my possessions in the pockets, an old gray sweater with the elbows out, the elbows, no socks. But I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I had a beat-up pair of old alligator shoes. And I'm sleeping in them hotels with the shoes tied around your neck, 45 cents a night, drinking wine. Grace didn't know where I was. And yet all she had to do was look out the west window of her office, 1.5 blocks west. And she'd see me fall out of this wine hotel, the New Harris. They tore it down about 2 months ago. And I'd crawl under those 18-wheelers and those dachshunds, because I know that area just like I know the back of both of my hands. I went home one time, the last year I drank, hoping that maybe she could have the key. Maybe we could get together. It's the only woman I've ever loved in my life. And I went home and I was drunk, and she looked at me and she says, "David, do you have to drink and do the things that you do?" And I guess it's the only truth I ever told her. I says, "I can't stop drinking." I said, "Grace, why don't you find another man that'll marry you, that'll be a husband to you? You're such a fine woman. And that'll be a good father to those two boys. I cannot function in either area or any area." And she'd turn her back and walk away, and I'd stumble back out. Somewhere along the line on April 18th of 1967, I found the handwriting on the floor of the Dallas County Jail. And I've been in lots of jails, and incidentally, that's not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. It certainly isn't. But by this time, I'd run out of people and run out of whiskey and run out of money, and it got down to me, and me couldn't stay sober, and me couldn't stay drunk, and me couldn't stay alive, and me couldn't kill myself, but me was going with me every place me went, and me didn't want me as me was anymore. And I screamed out, "My God, is there any help for me?" And something within me said, "Listen, you overeducated, pompous, egotistical, and spoiled little drunk, until you stop drinking, nobody can help you, not even me." Which is meant to me and means to me this up to this minute, that I was the one that had to have the desire and to stop drinking. That no one could do it to me, no one could do it for me, but I had to have stop. And I said to myself, if I just get out of here, I'm going to call those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I firmly believe that 28 years ago last August, a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous could see in me what I couldn't see in myself. They planted something in me. They were much like our co-founder Bill when he was running around the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in 1935 before AA got started. And he didn't know whether to go into the bar to listen to the tinkling of the ice and the music and the other chatter that goes on, or talk to a drunk. No, it wasn't necessary for Bill to talk to a drunk to Bill to try to carry the message to. It was necessary for Bill to talk to another alcoholic so Bill could stay sober. That's what was read before, that our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And little they realized what they had done for me, and I said, if I ever get out, I'm going to call them. Well, I didn't know where this gal Edith was, invited me to come to the birthday party. After I got sober, I found out that she'd passed away sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know where Moena was. I heard she'd moved away. But I see Moena every day now, every Wednesday rather, and she's sober 29 consecutive years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't going to call that spiritual talking woman. No, I wasn't going to do it. But today, that lady has helped me more understanding the nature of the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous than anyone else in the program, and she is one of the best friends that I have today. And my sponsor was also there at that birthday party. I was going to call him, but I heard that he had gotten drunk after 8 years, and I didn't know if he was sober again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called him, and he said, "Who is it for?" And I told him. He said, "Well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with. Don't you take a drink of alcohol today. And call me in the morning." And that's all he told me. And after 37 years of drinking, well, it just cold turkey. Well, like the silver in the southeast, more like frozen buzzards, you know. And I started just walking and shaking out of drunk and beating my head up against the wall, you know. And when I come to the next morning, I was sober.
And I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers, nor did I have a prescription for 500 more. And this is, I'm so thankful. It's a kind of sobering up that we don't hear much in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. Just walking and shaking out a drunk. I tell you, the best way to describe it, it's like natural childbirth without an anesthetic. It hurts like the devil, but you sure got a wide awake baby. I don't mind telling you. At 7:30, I called him again. And he said, are you drinking? And I said, no. He said, don't you take a drink of alcohol and call me at 3:30 this afternoon. I called him again at 3:30. He said, are you drinking? That's the first thing he'd ask me. I said, no. He said, do you really want to come to that meeting? And by this time, I was willing to crawl through 6 foot of snow naked just to see what kind of people you were that had this insatiable desire not to drink alcohol. And being about as humble as Hitler, I said, if you'll tell me where it is, I'll get there under my own steam. And he told me where it was, and he says, when you turn a corner, there's a whiskey store on the left and a beer joint on the right. Don't you stop buying, consuming the alcohol, because when I get there, I'm going to search you, David, and if you're drinking a drunk, I'm going to throw you right through the front door. You, David, cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking a drunk. And he hung up. Well, I was in a serious predicament. My wife, I'd heard, had thrown out all my clothes. And I didn't have but nothing what I told you. You know, that thermal underwear and old gray sweater. And the only money I had was 30 cents. And that was all that was left at the last blood I'd sold at the blood bank for wine. And when you're in that shape, you're not doing too good. And so I called up Grace and I said, Grace, and she hadn't heard from me quite a while. She said, who is this? And I said, me. And she said, who's me? I said, David. She said, oh. He said, what do you want? I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? And she says, yes, I have one, and it's to bury you in. As I look back now, I then ask her the most foolish question I ever asked in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, it's another one of your lies, be my guest, and hung up. Well, I finally went to that house, and I put on that old suit, that store in itself. Now, there wasn't instant joy when I come home and told them I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. There wasn't instant communication. It certainly wasn't. They'd write me notes, and I'd go over and get them, and as soon as I picked him up, and she'd spray. Everything I touched, she'd spray. And they'd stand at a distance and look. And I got on that suit, and I got into, I bid them goodbye, and I got into a Mustang that the bank was looking to repossess it, but they couldn't recognize it. It looked like an accordion. And off I went to the meeting. And I walked through the doors, and it looked like the same people that were there 17 years prior, grinning and smoking cigarettes. And there's a man stands at the door and greets all the Newmans as they come in. He stuck out his hand, and I grabbed it. And I hope I never forget that handshake as long as I live. His hand was dry, and mine was wet, and mine slipped away, and I had to grab it again. And I believe that's how we slip away from Alcoholics Anonymous, for getting wet again. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous has heard it, and I believe we need to hear it again and again and again and again and again. This man then said to me, welcome, come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee, and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. That is the greatest AA talk I ever heard in my life. Here was a sick, stinking, shaking drunk holding on to one of God's messengers as a result of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right there and then, he didn't realize it, but he instilled in me that there was no situation too difficult and no unhappiness too great that could not be overcome, and that a drink of alcohol will never make it any better. It'll make it worse. And then he introduced me to others. And it started a way of life. As the book says, we are normally people who would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding that's indescribably wonderful. And now for a few short moments, how it is today. I could have stood up here for hours and talked to you about the steps and traditions. We could have quoted poetry, told jokes. Bill says that, you know, we don't have any speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous, just talkers. It's the language of the heart. How you feel.
And I'd like to share with you the things that have happened to me as a result of my limited experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to You People Lived, I realized that my wife and two sons would ever be under one roof again. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon in my wife's life, that beautiful and wonderful woman, we celebrated our 35th consecutive wedding anniversary this past June the 10th, and that's pretty good for a drunk. Because, you see, that marriage had no right to be. It had been written off by everything and everybody. And it's a miracle. Now, I'm not going to tell you because I'm in AA and Grace is in Al-Anon that our marriage is perfect, that the blue birds are flying around and that all the butterflies are winking and kissing each other. No, we have a few short rounds. That's what you call clearing the air, communicating. I can best describe our marriage today that it's built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grew, but we didn't have a place to put our imperfections and communication. My two sons, God, one was going to kill me when he was 15 years of age, and today, both of them. One couldn't go to school. He'd shake his head, and he'd bite his fingernails, and he'd crawl under the bed and scream and holler. And today, they're wonderful young men today, successful, and we not only have a beautiful father and son relationship, but more important, we're the best of friends. When I got sober, I had to go to state board of dental examiners because they were looking for me with papers to remove my license for the rest of my life. Practice dentistry in any state in the union, and also not to have anything to do with any of its allied businesses and professions along with it. And I had to go to them and tell them the truth. Sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous said, "What are you going to tell them?" I said, "I'm going to tell them I'm in AA." They said, "Oh, no, you're not. Promises kill drunks. Don't you promise them that you'll do good. You promise them you've been sober. You've been doing that all you. You don't know what you're going to do. Just tell them what you did, not what you're going to do. You don't know what you're going to do." I said, "Do I have to?" They said, "If you want to stay sober, you will." And so I went to them and I told them of all the rotten things and all the people's money I'd taken. Never did their work. Work I did, I wouldn't have it in my mouth or anybody else's mouth. And they said, "You mean to tell us you don't have a lawyer?" And I said, "I'm just down here to find out what I got to do." They said, "We never heard anything like that around here before." We went for 7 days. He said, "You got any equipment?" I said, "I got two pieces, but the sheriff is looking to repossess them. He can't find them." He said, "You got a place to work?" I said, "No." On the 8th day, they said, "Well, if you can find the two pieces of equipment and a place to work, you go back to work, and we'll be checking up on you one day at a time." And one of the doctors that was there five years ago gave my 25-year key in the American Dental Association last May the 10th is 30. And on the 28th day of August of 1978, this year, 28 years from the exact date that I was asked to come to that birthday party, I received a letter from the governor of the state that I reside in telling me that three others and myself were recommended for two vacancies on the State Board of Dental Examiners in the state. Commencing the first year. And you see, this is not me. This is all Alcoholics Anonymous. Because ours is not a personal success story, but one of colossal human failure converted into great strength by the alchemy of the living grace of God, as expressed through the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and our fellowship therein. So you see, only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, I have a sober life today. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th of 1967. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a God today, a God of my very own, a God that I found through the 12 steps and through the big book as a result of you people and from nowhere else. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a family today that loves and respects me. I have the best way to make a living I've ever had in my life. I have a roof over my head. I have a few dollars in my pocket. I've got a
couple of these fancy new renter suits with vests. I've got hundreds of thousands of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon and Alateen in the outside world. I've got two cars with gasoline in them. I've got meat in the refrigerator and groceries in the pantry, and I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you're either oversexed or plumb nuts. There was a little boy that was an orphan in orphanage in the Midwest. And he had a terrible stuttering impediment. God, every time he opened his mouth and he'd stutter, and the more he became excited, the worse the stuttering. And it just drove him to utter distraction and almost drove him crazy. And the youngsters all knew this, and they would make him do this, and as long as he reacted, he'd try to talk, and when he did, he'd stutter, and he became perfectly miserable, and he got to the point to where he was different. And he even tried to kill himself one day by hanging himself in a chinaberry tree. But something happened to that little youngster. He'd walk around and he'd just beam at everybody and he'd look at him with that good look. And no matter how hard anybody tried to get him to open his mouth, no matter how they told him, how they'd aggravate him, he wouldn't open his mouth. And as long as he didn't open his mouth, he wouldn't stutter or try to talk. And he just walked around and became a beautiful youngster. And then one Sunday morning, the visiting preacher didn't show up, so the superintendent of the orphanage called for a volunteer to read the devotional prayer. And little stuttering Johnny held his hand up, and the superintendent looked at him and said, "Johnny, are you sure you know what you're doing?" And Johnny just nodded his head and grinned, and the superintendent says, "Well, come on." And so little Johnny got behind the lectern, and he opened up the devotional prayer book, and he began to read. As he began to read, each letter was perfectly enunciated. Each word was perfectly pronunciated. And as he began to read, there came from within him a look, the same look that I saw in Edith's eyes in that barber shop, the same look that I see in your eyes, this look that I wanted so bad when I came to you people, the look that I know now what it is that God is doing for us, what we could not possibly do for ourselves." And as this little Johnny read, the look became more beautiful. And finally, when he finished and he said amen, there was a deathly silence. After the services were over with, the superintendent ran over to little Johnny. And he put his arms around him and he kissed him on the forehead and he says, "Johnny, do you realize what you have just done? You read those prayers perfectly. You didn't stutter even once." And little Johnny, standing on his tiptoes and looking up at the superintendent and beaming from ear to ear, he said, "Mr. Superintendent, when I read and when I talk to the God of my understanding, I do not stutter. Because he loves me." God bless each and every one of you so much, and I love you so much.